Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect podcast. I'm Ellen Halliday, deputy editor at Prospect, and today I'm delighted to be joined by journalist and author Phil Tinline to discuss an essay he wrote for the most recent issue of the magazine on the defenders of US democracy who are preparing to resist the slide into autocracy that they fear would follow if Trump was re-elected. Phil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Phil, your piece in the magazine this month is called The Resistance, and you pitched it some months ago when the prospect of Trump winning the candidacy, let alone being a potentially likely winner of the US presidential election, wasn't as clear as it is now. So why did you want to write this particular story about, as you call them, the resistance?
Generally speaking, and this is off the back of probably too much reading on this subject since about 2004, I'm pretty skeptical about warnings that democracy is about to fall over. Because if you look back through the 20th century in Britain, I think the same is true in America, although I've not studied it in the same depth, there are an awful lot of them. And what I eventually concluded, and this was part of the subject of my first book, was that they're often part of the process of a democracy slowly and painfully changing its mind. And when you can't see a way through democratically, then that's when, you know, non-democratic solutions start to crowd in and it's sort of catnip to extremists. But on the other hand, I listened to Trump's Waco speech last year and was, you know, absolutely sort of struck between the eyes by quite how full on this was, quite how aggressive it was, and the sorts of things that he was talking about doing did not sound like, you know, the actions of a Democrat. So what I wanted to do was to be really specific about it, because I think generalized warnings that, you know, everything's going to hell or we're going to end up like Nazi Germany in 1933 don't get us all that far. I wanted to be really specific and find out exactly what people thought he was saying and thought he was going to do, and then, because it's rather kind of helpless to just leave it hanging there, find out what they propose to do about it.
I mean, in a general way, we're all familiar with the kind of things that Trump says. What were some of those specific things he was saying that made you think, okay, now is the time to get into the detail?
Well, he was talking about, he used the phrase, "I am your retribution." He was basically talking about the Democrats. He sort of says it's not enough to call them socialists. He's a communist, he's a globalist, both extremely freighted words, not least in the context of conspiracy theory in America. Globalist has all sorts of connotations. He was saying that, you know, these people are out to destroy the country. He was saying that Biden was basically weaponizing the justice system against him. But it was also the fact that he was making this speech at Waco. Now, he was making it at the airport. He wasn't literally making it at the site of the famous, infamous siege in 1993, where this sort of small cultish group of religious sort of people living on the in isolation, the Branch Davidians, were besieged by the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, and it dragged on for a couple of months. And in the end, it was all brought to a close, astonishingly, on the anniversary of the beginning of the American Revolution, which had an enormous impact on the American hard right, the militia movement, patriot movement's already going. So to go to that place of all places available in the United States to make a speech that's so associated with a vision of civil war was extraordinary itself. And then to begin it with, you know, people who'd been jailed over January the 6th singing, and then to say the things he was saying, that seemed like a big step away from where we had been.
Mm-hmm. I mean, loaded with symbolism that speaks to a certain swathe of the American right, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the book I'm writing at the moment is partly about what was happening on the American hard right in the 1990s, and there's another incident at somewhere called Ruby Ridge, but what Waco makes a lot of people think, because a lot of people believe that the government sets the fire. Now, I think there's good evidence, given tapes of what was going on inside and what David Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidians, was doing, that actually they set the fire, that it was a sort of apocalyptic suicide. But many, many people believed, including Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, that it had been done by the government. And there's a right-wing broadcaster called William Cooper, broadcasting from Arizona, who goes to Waco and says, folks, you're next. This is the place that Alex Jones makes his name. You know, so the sort of the roots of the imagery that are being tugged on now go right back to the mid-90s.
Can you maybe also just remind people who Alex Jones is?
So Alex Jones, the notorious far-right broadcaster on InfoWars, who has ended up with a huge billion-strong bill for wrongfully accusing people who had lost their children in a school shooting somewhere called Sandy Hook, accusing them of having been party to that whole thing being a fraud. The people who are seeing the world in those sorts of extreme terms, who think everything that they don't like is a false flag, is a government trick, you know, they really have strong roots in that moment. So to go for Trump to go to that place and make a speech like that really struck me between the eyes.
I mean, you, I'm sure, will have been watching Trump's campaign the first time around, the first time he ran, to an extent. Do you think there's a tangible difference between his previous campaign and now? Are things more worrying? Are these symbols, were these symbols there before and we just didn't see them?
I think some of the symbolism was, but I think there's a degree to which he appears to feel wronged and humiliated and hurt, for which he wants to seek vengeance, basically. Now, he clearly had elements of that in his offer before that. I mean, there's this famous incident in 2011 at the White House correspondence dinner where he's sitting there and Obama, who has been subject to Trump boosting the conspiracy theory that Obama had no right to be president because he allegedly wasn't born in the United States. But Obama has Trump sitting there, a sort of sitting duck, on camera, and he, you know, roundly sends him up. And you can see Trump almost audibly sort of fuming. And, you know, it's too simplistic to say that's the only reason he ran for president. He was talking about it in the late 80s. But there was something of it last time in 2016. But that's one thing that's changed, is that's become much more intense. But the other one is that it's not just Trump. You know, the whole infrastructure around him is planning much more efficiently and effectively than it was last time. Last time they didn't expect to win. He was retailing the sort of election fraud story in advance, getting it ready for when Hillary won. And indeed, Hillary Clinton did win, you know, the popular vote by more than 2 million votes, I think. But this time, they know who they want to appoint. They've worked through things legally, and they are much readier than they were before. And that's the big thing I learned from writing the piece. That is a big difference.
I absolutely want to get into all of that and kind of the specifics of what it is that they have planned. Just before we do, I mean, it's very early April. There are several months ago before the presidential election. There are also several obstacles in Trump's way. So what lies between him and winning the US presidential election at this point?
Well, I mean, obviously he could simply lose to Biden. But apart from that, there are fully six legal cases, I think four criminal and two civil, that are ongoing. I mean, it's immensely complex, but the six cases are, there's a federal election case over his conduct during the 2020 transition and whether he tried to defraud the electorate. There's then a specific case on the same grounds in Georgia, from Fulton County, Georgia. There are then other cases which don't relate directly to the election, but obviously have a bearing on whether people might or might not want to vote for him, and also on whether it may possibly stop him one way or another. One is about allegedly wrongfully removing documents from the White House and keeping them at Mar-a-Lago. There is a civil fraud case about allegedly inflating the value of some of his holdings. There is a libel case, a second defamation case brought by E. Jean Jean Carroll after he allegedly libeled her after the first case was decided in her favour. And there is a case over hush money, the payments of hush money allegedly to silence somebody he had allegedly slept with. But, you know, it is very difficult to say, given all of that, you know, and given the kind of constant shifts backwards and forwards on trial dates, on the amount of money he's having to pay and so on whether or not he is immune on the basis that he was taking these decisions on January the 6th in an official capacity, whether or not he'll be stopped. And I am no legal expert and wouldn't pretend to be, certainly not on American law. And so it is certainly possible, I think, intuitively, that something may stop him, but it does seem quite unlikely.
And I mean, for anybody who's sort of trying to keep track of all of the, you know, the charges, counts against Trump, there is quite a helpful piece in The Atlantic called The Cases Against Trump, A Guide by David A. Graham, which I believe they're updating over the course of the next few months. So I would direct people there as well. It's very thorough, explains the what, where, whens and whys. So, yeah, that's quite helpful. But to Trump and his plan. So you said that compared to 2016, this time around, Trump and indeed his wider team maybe have a clearer idea of actually what they want to do when they get in. Is there kind of a neat summary of that, you know, action plan, that playbook?
I'll do my best. I mean, part of the whole problem here, part of the whole issue, is the immense complexity of the American system and the immense creativity that goes into, critics might say gaming, others might say creatively deploying all sorts of aspects of that. So some of the ones that I picked out in the piece are seeking to take direct control of the Department of Justice. And also, you know, I should say that the reason that they want to do this is, you know, from their perspective, you know, at least this is the argument made and why they have support. You know, it's not like it's just 30 people on their own. They do have huge public support, is that there is a sense that, you know, there is a sort of liberal hegemony that needs to be, you know, rooted out. And so that's the sort of thinking that's leading to these. So taking control of the Department of Justice, gutting the FBI and effectively sort of starting again. And I think partly from sort of Trump's personal set tos with the FBI. Control of the Federal Communications Commission, which control, you know, regulates the media. Using the pardon power, both for himself and for other people, possibly the January the 6th, people convicted over the invasion of the Capitol on January the 6th. Something called Schedule F, which involves redefining people who are currently defined as civil servants, officials, as political appointees, which makes it much easier to jettison them. They also have lists of people that they want to bring in instead. And there's all sorts of more specific things as well to do with removing security clearances. It goes right down to a sort of granular level. But it's those sorts of things. And the other two that are really important are using the Insurrection Act and something called the Alien Enemies Act from 1798, if you please, to, and this is an astonishing piece of creativity, to, in the latter case, to, because what that law allows you to do is deport people who are citizens of a country with which the United States is at war. So the idea is that you take drug cartels in Mexico, declare them enemy states, and then anybody that you can associate with those drug cartels, you can then deport from the country. And he has talked about, you know, deporting people in the millions. I mean, there's a fear of sort of, you know, mass roundups with due process not necessarily, you know, carried through. So that's the sort of the external version. There's the what's going to hit the government, and then there's what's going to hit members of the public.
I mean, with a lot of those things that you listed, I mean, each of them individually already sounds pretty dramatic, starting, you know, basically restarting the FBI, mass roundups. And I guess one of the big questions is how is that possible? Surely American democracy is resilient enough to withstand such efforts on the part of an individual and his campaign. So what did you find?
Well, so I think that this is, just more broadly first, this is the kind of the key thing, and this is why I'm always wary of, you know, democracy is on the verge of disaster, because, you know, if you look at what happened last time, you know, there were the fullness of Trump's plans was not just on January the 6th to 2021 was not just about sort of a mob invading the Capitol. That was the kind of last ditch, you know, plan E. That was the backup plan. There were, you know, he wanted to kind of do much more concerted things, and he couldn't because people resisted. You know, in the sort of hierarchy in Georgia, these are conservative Republicans. They said no. A man called Gabriel Sterling, who I think worked for the Georgia Attorney General, went on television and said this has to stop. You know, there was a real sense of resistance from people inside the machine, regardless of where they stood politically on the broad left-right spectrum. So what I found specifically that people were talking about doing, I mean, some of this is more theoretical, some of it's more sort of, you know, in action. But, you know, it is possible to block funding if you have the right number of people in House of Representatives. It is possible to block appointments if you have the right number of people in the Senate. It may be that the Supreme Court, much as it has three Trump appointees on it and a conservative supermajority, may prove more resistant than we think. The Supreme Court did not accept the idea that the election was fraudulent in 2020. That's quite significant and not much discussed, I think. And I think there's something there which I think is really interesting, which I hadn't clocked at all before I wrote the piece, which is that if you think about it, being a sort of traditional hardline conservative Republican who's very interested in pretty unfettered free markets and that sort of thing, the kind of people who drove the sort of legal movement around the Federal Society, though, which has been instrumental in those appointments to the Supreme Court, those are not ideologically people in the same position as Trumpist authoritarians. Now, they have formed a kind of alliance, but once you're in power, those kind of alliances come under pressure. So it may be that actually we see a surprising degree of resistance from that quarter. And one thing that somebody said to me in the piece, which again hadn't occurred to me at all, is that actually one of the parts of that sort of legal activism sort of long march that's been happening since really the early 80s is that it's become more ordinary, more normative for judges to be skeptical about law, to be a bit more sort of almost activist. Now, it may be that they direct that to what the Trump administration does. So that's one part of it. But it remains to be seen, particularly in Congress, whether they have the numbers to do anything about that. There are other more specific things to do with federal agency relocations, which are being talked about, for example, as a means of purging staff. Now, they may come, they may run afoul of something called the Government Accountability Office and its best practice laws.
Is that literally shifting HQ of some big organisations so that people no longer want to work there, like the current staff no longer want to work there?
Right. And you know, that is, on the face of it, a perfectly benign, decentralising thing to do. You know, the Treasury here has moved significant parts of its offices to Darlington. You know, that is not a move to kind of, you know, defenestrate, you know, lefty civil servants. It's trying to push power around the country. So, you know, there will be justifications for it, but there is, it is pretty clear that that is why they want to do that, to you know, effectively force people, you know, to choose between moving 3,000 miles and, you know, losing their job. So that, but that could, as I say, that could run afoul of particular, you know, restrictions. I mean, an awful lot of this comes down to when it's put under sufficient pressure, what is really a law, what is a rule, and what is a sort of normative standard of behaviour. And I think sometimes people think things that are norms have more legal force than they do. And there's a whole bunch of other things that people are talking, you know, preparing to do legal challenges to roundups of undocumented migrants, looking at case law on the illegality of politically motivated prosecutions. And that's really kind of what I wanted to get at, was what are people thinking through now to match the people around Trump who are thinking things through as well. And that's the big difference, is last time everyone was caught by surprise. Mm-hmm. This time quite a lot of people are intent not to be.
After the break, we'll talk more about Trump and the people who believe they're fighting to save American democracy. But first, I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the new Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration, plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and Android.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So you spoke to various advocacy organizations, groups in the US who were kind of mobilizing around this idea that democracy needs defending. And maybe last time there was sort of a sense among many people of a degree of ineptitude in the organization and in the administration. But the fear is that ineptitude will no longer be there. They've got a plan. So democracy's defenders need a plan too. So, I mean, tell us, there's lots of small pieces to Trump's plan in the picture that you've painted. There's the use of really old legislation, there's kind of breaking down norms, all that kind of stuff. So how does a country like America stand up against that? And how do these groups organize to kind of push back?
Well, as I say, part of it is you know, really sort of rigorously and creatively mining the law books. And it's very striking that a new society, the Society for the Rule of Law, has been set up by three, I think, pretty conservative senior lawyers to try and bring people together to organize on that sort of basis. There's this thing called the Brennan Center, which I think is at New York University, which is doing similar work, particularly looking at the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 and so on. And then there are various organizations. And what's really striking about these organizations is a lot of them are either Republican or bipartisan. So somebody made the point that they have people on their staff, I think this is at Protect Democracy, that they have people on their staff who are former Ted Cruz staffers, as well as former Elizabeth Warren staffers. You know, you have Liz Cheney, the daughter of Dick Cheney, a conservative Republican, former congresswoman for Wyoming. You know, you have the McCain Institute, a conservative institute named after a stalwart Republican. And you have, you know, the thing called the Republican Accountability Project, run by somebody called Sarah Longwell. So there are all these organizations, either on the center-right or more broadly across the spectrum, which are trying to do the things I've already described, but also kind of trying to get people to take this seriously. Because, you know, as I was saying at the beginning, you know, there is a bit of a kind of crying wolf element to this. You know, there have been many, many times when people have talked about tyranny in America. And so it's kind of hard to persuade people, I think, that this time is different. There's also a great weariness, I think. It was a report in the New York Times the last couple of days about, you know, a column sort of making the case for, you know, being excited about this election, but clearly off the back of a quite broad feeling of like these, it's a rerun, a rematch between two old men who've both been president, who are both quite unpopular. So I think there's quite a lot of that that these people are trying to fight against, a sort of sense of weariness and inertia and apathy, you know, which is there for perfectly good reasons. But part of it, precisely because, as you said, you know, is there a play? But all there kind of is, but it's complicated, is to sort of say it often enough to get it into people's heads.
One of the things that really came through when I read your first draft is that the plan that Team Trump has is kind of frightening. Is the message from these democracy advocates to say we should be frightened and let's do something about it? Or is fear the kind of mobilizing emotion?
I mean, I think, you know, they I'm just trying to think how many of them actually used the word fear. I couldn't say off the top of my head, but I think there's clearly a sense of, you know, at the very least, you know, serious urgent concern. I think some people are frightened. I think maybe there's a feeling that fear can be a little bit debilitating. It can be a little bit rabbit in headlights. I talked to somebody in New York when I was last in the States who simultaneously was sort of saying, well, you know, it's going to be terrible if he wins, but what do I do about that? You know, so I think it's trying to kind of go around that. But yeah, I think people are frightened.
And so how do you get around that?
I think that's maybe partly what I was trying to do with this piece, you know, is to be specific, to say, if you say Trump is like Hitler, or Trump is a fascist, or Trump wants to be a dictator, well, even if you can make a kind of, you know, detailed historical case for that, it doesn't really help very much, because you're not talking about what he's going to do, you're talking about what he notionally is. And that's why I think talking, you know, following on from what these groups have been doing about the specifics of what he's planning, I think that then can be visualized and people can start thinking about, you know, their reaction to that and what they might do to organize. Now, obviously, if you are a 20-year-old activist with lots of energy and not very much money, you might respond one way, or if you're a 60-year-old lawyer, you might respond in a different way. But I think knowing the specifics both makes the case more tenable that there is something to be worried about here, and allows people to think about what they might do.
And who do you think these democracy advocates are speaking to when they're being specific, when they're saying this is what Trump's doing? Are they speaking to your average American? I don't know even who that is. People will envision a different average American. Or are they speaking to, as you say, lawyers? Are they speaking to people in government?
I mean, this is the really difficult thing. What I say is, in the piece, is the hard problem, in a way, is that, you know, for millions and millions of Americans, which is, on the face of it, perfectly reasonable, certainly perfectly democratic, they see, you know, Biden and the general sort of quote-unquote liberal offer, and that has all sorts of iterations, you don't need me to detail, they see that as a serious threat. You know, there is a brilliant sociologist called Arlie Russell Hochschild, who wrote a book called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, which was actually written before Trump was elected the first time, based on 5 years of, you know, field work in Louisiana. Now, this is somebody who is, you know, absolutely left of center, lives in California, you know, as it happens, married to Adam Hochschild, but, you know, a really major left of center sociologist. And that book is a really sort of profoundly empathetic effort to understand how the world looks to people who she'd been talking to. There's then a section at the end of the book where she fact checks that, but there is that element to it which is necessary. And, you know, I'm not sure whether this sort of activism is necessarily getting there. I think this is more aimed, to be honest, at people who are, you know, concerned, highly informed Republicans, are, you know, the professional middle class, are, you know, the person I spoke to in New York who didn't know what to do, but, you know, is empowered and highly educated. I think there's a whole different conversation to happen, which is where I spoke to Whitney Phillips, an academic at University of Oregon, who works on conspiracy theory and sort of media frames and all that sort of thing, you know, which is quite, quite different, you know, which is about more like what Arlie Russell Hochschild's doing, sort of engaging with people, you know, at that sort of, not emotional level exactly, but engaging with their worldview, engaging with their fears, engaging with their demons, and then you can kind of swap notes on your demons, and that's a whole other project. I think there's a kind of an immediate, urgent Washington sort of beltway version of it, which is more what I've been documenting, and what I try and point to at the end of the piece is a project that, frankly, really needs doing, even if Biden wins decisively.
On that kind of immediate beltway side of things, I mean, how impressed, I guess, were you by the work that they're doing? And do you think that they'll succeed if Trump does win? Would you feel optimistic about their efforts to protect the things he wants to undermine?
I mean, I don't want to, from a journalistic point of view, be too sort of, you know, points out of 10 about it, but I'd certainly say that the work they're doing is highly detailed, and that they are thinking about, you know, a whole range of stuff, right down to sort of, you know, helping worried civil servants feel a sense of solidarity, feel a sense of, you know, helping them with personal security, all the way up to petitions to Congress and complex legal arguments. So certainly the range and depth of effort is striking. Do I feel optimistic? Not especially. And I think, as I say, I think even if Biden wins, actually, something really difficult to deal with has happened in America, to do with, you know, the obvious things, to do with polarization. And I don't think it's just the media. I actually think, and this is maybe a pat observation, but again, from when I was last there, traveling around by train, you know, just taking time to just watch the landscape, you know, the space between people's houses is very, very different. You know, it's an enormous place. The idea that it could function as a democracy in the first place actually is really remarkable. You know, and this is possibly why they talk about it so much. The idea that you sustain that immensity as a single well-functioning democracy for all the problems and faults and, you know, terrible things it's, you know, been subject to, that's actually kind of astonishing in a way that it isn't really in Britain. And that's a difference we really should attend to.
Yeah. I mean, as we're sitting here in London, I mean, I'm sure that over the coming months we will increasingly be watching more and more coverage, getting more and more worried about, you know, potentially the outcome for American democracy. But what can people do, do you think, from over here? Was that a conversation that you had with the advocates in America?
It wasn't. I mean, I have a, I don't know if you remember, a campaign that was run by The Guardian in 2004, where The Guardian got invited its readers to write to people, I think in Ohio, and explain why they shouldn't vote for Bush. And this, as you might imagine, did not get an especially warm reaction. And for perfectly good reasons. You know, at one level, it is none of our damn business. You know, it's their own democracy. If we started having Americans saying, well, you should vote for Rishi Sunak, or you should vote for, you know, Richard Tice, or you should vote for Keir Starmer, then, you know, we might not, you know, accept it particularly warmly either. So I think the useful thing that you can do from here really is to focus. I mean, there's, you know, one reason to write the piece, I guess, although it's obviously mainly for a British audience, is to focus on the specifics. You know, I think there's a world of difference between saying he proposes to take the Alien Enemies Act and use it to declare cartels as enemy states and therefore deport people of Mexican background who are undocumented. That is very different from saying Trump is going to set up concentration camps. You know, and I think all you can do is report and be specific.
Given the focus on specifics, then, are there any lessons for what people in other democracies can do to safeguard their own democracies? Is there a transferable, you know, message there?
I think the differences are at least as striking as similarities. But yeah, I think I would apply exactly the same thing here. I mean, you know, there are, over the last 5 years, there have been, you know, real causes for concern to do with laws restricting protests, to do with, you know, the prorogation of parliament and so on, all sorts of things. And not purely coming from the Conservative government, but obviously that was quite a big part of a lot of people's concerns. But there's also concerns about free speech and cancelling and so on from a more Conservative perspective, which should be taken seriously as well. And again, I think, you know, less analogy, less projection, less slippery slope logic, and more, you know, attending to, if you think there's a problem, talk about that problem. It's much less persuasive, much less helpful, I think, to say, well, you might like this thing, but if it carries on, it will turn into, you know, Nazi Germany. Now, obviously, we want a sense of warning and harbinger about things as well, but I think we should be much more careful with that than we sometimes are.
Phil, that's really interesting. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. And I would obviously direct all readers to go and look at your piece in full on our website if they can't get their hands on a physical copy of the magazine. It's all there online. Phil, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for now. Thanks so much to Phil for joining us, and thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or to our app, where you can read Phil's report, as well as pieces by Isabel Hilton on the environmental damage in Ukraine, Sam Friedman on the Greens and English politics, and much, much more. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.